I have people that I know that I'll be making constant eye contact with them only, but I'll just look past you, hopefully. All right, let's get started. Thank you all for coming even after yesterday, those of you who were there yesterday. I'll never forget the day I was hired at Rockbridge Academy, in large part because I couldn't believe I was hired. I just turned 23 years old, and it was 2 weeks before the start of school. I never taught a day in my life, much less spoken formally in front of a group of more than about 15 of my peers. The textbook that our students were using was Wheelock's Latin, one of the few texts I had absolutely no experience with. I was so new to classical Christian education, I recall fumbling the question during my job interview, who is responsible for the education of the child? Oh yeah, the parents. I thought it was a trick question. When they brought me in to teach a practice class to a few students, I remember trying to teach them everything about infinitives and indirect statements in 45 minutes. I now take closer to 2 or 3 weeks on that chapter. The second most unbelievable thing they told me beyond, you've got the job, was, you're the Latin expert in the school now. You take the program where it needs to go. Here I thought I had to focus on keeping my job into next week, and the school was now declaring me the Latin department vision caster. At the time, I had two basic principles that I wanted to follow. I wanted to teach Latin in such a way that the students loved it. And I wanted them to be able to read classical Latin by the end of their training. When I first flipped through Wheelock's Latin, I thought to myself, so much for teaching Latin in such a way that the students love it. This book contained the most deductive approach to learning Latin I had ever seen. Each chapter was entitled something frightening, like chapter 4, second declension neuters, semicolon, present indicative of sum, semicolon, predicate nouns and adjectives, as opposed to chapter 4, Quintus and Marcus spend the day at the games. And I was slated to use this book with students as young as 6th grade. One reason I was willing to give Wheelock's Latin the benefit of the doubt was what I had seen from former classmates who had been trained on some other more inductive approaches. The American high schools that used less grammar-based approaches were not, in my experience, producing students who could read the language. And yet, many of these students were majoring in Latin in college with the goal of becoming teachers. They couldn't even translate with confidence as undergraduates. In fact, many of these high schools were offering a glorified class in Latin derivatives that was a safety net for kids who failed out of Spanish. A typical class period might be spent drawing a crayon picture of a tree, and on the trunk you would write a Latin verb, and on the branches you would write a verb that came from a word in English that came from that Latin verb. And that's certainly appropriate for a class of third or fourth graders, but not for someone who ought to be a couple years away from reading Virgil. And so in my first year of teaching, I set sail with great trepidation, knowing little more than what I wanted and what I didn't want my Latin students to become. It's been almost 5 years since that day. So what I hope to give you in this talk today is most certainly not the only right way to teach Latin in your school, but merely a look at what we do at Rockbridge Academy and why we think it's successful. Before you decide the first thing about your school's Latin program, including what grade to begin teaching it, and certainly before you decide on a textbook, you need to determine the goal of having your students study the Latin language. And it was never in doubt that we wanted Rockbridge students to study Latin grammar and vocabulary so they could read classical Latin. We do not seek to produce students who can speak Latin conversationally, though I'm convinced that if I were trained in conversational Latin, which I'm not, I could use spoken Latin as a means to make my students better readers. Last year's talks at the ACCS conference by Matthew Fraser on the benefits of teaching Latin in much the same way as we teach modern spoken foreign languages were fascinating and thought-provoking. He left me very much convinced that spoken Latin teaching techniques can produce competent Latin readers, not to mention a cadre of students who have a very select club across America with a secret spoken language that completely outclasses Pig Latin. For a number of reasons, our school has opted not to use spoken Latin as the primary teaching method. First reason is this. Latin conversation is seldom about anything like the topics that are covered in classical and medieval literature. The vocabulary is different, and beyond a certain point, there is very little overlap. I've argued yesterday that the natural reward of learning Latin is the ability to access a large portion of the Western canon in its original language. To the extent that spoken Latin does not give us that reward, it's only a contributor to the attainment of it. But by itself, spoken Latin cannot replace careful translation to and from the ancient tongues, along with the learning of grammar. Secondly, there's a vast gulf in the form of oral speech and written language, the complexity of sentence structure, and the general organization. Have you ever heard of someone who talks like a book? Perhaps Bill Buckley? We make that observation only because it's unusual and remarkable. There's an expectation that speech and written language ought to be different. The third reason why we haven't adopted spoken Latin is that our goal is not only to read, but to analyze as well. If you are to argue about meaning, establish claims by scrutiny of grammar, or do lexical surveys to pin down the semantic range of a word, then you will need something other than whole language immersion. And the fourth reason why we have not adopted the spoken Latin approach, although it's far from philosophical, is that we've got no one on staff who could pull it off. However, Matthew Fraser's talk was enough to get us to agree to do what we could to use more spoken Latin in the classroom, make certain expressions more comfortable and habitual for the students. So to summarize, spoken Latin is definitely cool, definitely difficult, and we believe not the only or the best way to produce a competent reader of Latin literature. In much the same way do we view Latin prose composition, or translating from English to Latin. We do this as much as possible in all grades, but our goal is again not to have our students write their senior theses or doctoral dissertations in Latin, but to read Golden Age classical Latin. Insofar as this task is effective in training our students to think lexically and grammatically like the Roman authors they will read, we find it to be an excellent tool. And occasionally, I've heard of a school that wants to teach Latin only to present basic grammar, vocabulary, and derivatives to the students. At these schools, there is no desire to read, speak, or write the language. And so, while they give their students something of considerable value in the fundamentals of Latin, my talk today will not give much help for schools hoping to implement such a program. So, to be very clear about my agenda, I am here to share with you how Rockbridge Academy, my school, has organized its Latin program to teach students to read classical Latin. One question that never crossed my mind when I began teaching 5 years ago was whether or not every student is cut out for a Latin curriculum like ours. And over the years, I've seen students struggle in every way imaginable with Latin. And it can be very difficult to diagnose what the catch is for these students. For some, I suspect it is a work ethic issue, but for others, I truly believe God has shaped their minds in a very un-Latin way. So if I'm holding up my end of the bargain as a teacher, and so are my students, I still don't expect all of them to earn A's. I do expect that all of them will grow in their appreciation for the complexity and rigor of Latin and in all of the non-linguistic aspects that it offers. So, is Latin for every student? The answer, I believe, is a definite yes, just as not every student is to the same degree adept at mathematics, so not every student will take to Latin. But regardless of their work ethics and God-given abilities, every student I have taught so far has understood well what it takes to translate Latin, whether or not they all have the same aptitude. A little bit later in this talk, I'll speak to how our school is for the first time next year tracking students into A and B track 10th grade level Latin classes. Now, on to who should teach Latin. I think I made it abundantly clear that when I was hired, I probably wouldn't have hired myself. I'm eternally grateful to our headmaster and the board of directors for seeing something in me that either wasn't there yet or hadn't been uncovered. Rockbridge will turn you into a teacher if it's at all possible. I'm thankful that they never stopped trying on me. So my advice as to what a Latin teacher should be comes with the caveat that while I have studied Latin nearly all my life and taught it for 5 years, I certainly haven't been a Latin teacher for 5 years. You're constantly tweaking, constantly improving. And since there are so many levels of Latin to teach at a school, it's probably unreasonable to expect to hire a teacher at every level who has a degree in Latin. I think so long as a candidate is passionate about the language, loves the Lord, and knows the curriculum required for his grade level, you have a perfect fit for the time being. That said, I think every Latin teacher should be the sort of lifelong learner that we talk about so frequently. If your knowledge of Latin grammar ends with the active voice of verbs and the first three noun declensions, because that's all you teach, why not spend the summer studying the passive voice and polishing off the remaining sets of nouns. Then spend the next summer on the subjunctive mood and its nefarious clauses. A Latin teacher who can teach youngsters with the next year in mind will be more effective. And if you can find it, every student appreciates a Latin teacher with at least a slight sense of humor and a boatload of patience. I'm still working on that last one, and in a couple years I'll probably need a sabbatical for blood pressure. Once a teacher has been hired for the highest level of Latin in your school, it's probably not unusual for the administration to say, "You're the expert now, take us where you will." So you now have the right to pick exactly which authors and works you will read with your older students. The choice boils down to selections from either classical Latin or what I've called on the outline medieval Latin, though I could have simply lumped all non-classical Latin together, from the Vulgate Bible to John Calvin to Isaac Newton to How the Grinch Stole Christmas. There are only a few rules of thumb to follow there. First, teach the authors you know and love. My training makes it easier for me to read authors like Caesar, Cicero, Livy, Virgil, Ovid, Horace, Catullus, and Pliny. But I don't love all these authors to the same degree. So my students and I enjoy a curriculum heavy on Cicero and Ovid. Secondly, as a teacher at a classical Christian school, you are wise to avoid reading much of Catullus and some portions of Horace and Ovid as well. Unless, of course, we want our students reading about how best to attract a man with the help of makeup. Not all classical Latin is equally beautiful and true, so while I don't hide this aspect from my students, I mention it, and I move on to spending our time and effort on the authors and works that shine much brighter. And finally, the grammar and vocabulary that you teach to your younger kids is more likely than not reflective of the authors that I just named. I've not heard of a Latin grammar text created with the express purpose of teaching students to read post-classical Latin. However, I suspect one exists just off my radar, or will start existing now that I said it didn't. I do think it's a great idea to read some Vulgate Bible or St. Augustine with your students once they've finished sampling the ancient Romans. This allows them to see not only the flower of Christendom in the Roman Empire, but also the simplification of Latin grammar over the years as it's well on its way to becoming a Romance language. When my students read from the Vulgate Bible, they say that it feels ridiculously easy. And this isn't only because they know the content already. The grammar of fourth century literary Latin is a cakewalk compared to the Ciceronian style. So in summary, teach what you know, teach what you enjoy, and teach what will really benefit the student as he builds upon his grammar years. So, how do we pursue the study of Latin according to the trivium? How do we get from kids who can't tell their genitive from their dative to kids who can read and explain a passage of Cicero? And the answer is not overnight. At Rockbridge Academy, we begin the exploration of Latin grammar, vocabulary, and syntax in the third grade, meeting for 30 minutes, 5 days a week. I think it's only logical to keep the grammar of Latin fairly in line with what they're learning in English. There's no good sense in teaching a grammar stage student a passive verb in Latin before they're comfortable with the term in their own language. For the next 3 years, our students will memorize vocabulary and the most fundamental declensions and conjugations. The key here is repetition and practice. Students need time to practice talking about Latin using the proper terms. Person, number, tense, voice, mood, case, gender, principal part, infinitive, predicate nominative, etc. Nothing derails a class's progress more than calling on a student who's zoned out, likely singing a commercial jingle in his head, and asking him, "Tim, what tense is docuit in this sentence?" And you can see him snap to attention as the McDonald's "I'm loving it" jingle evaporates from his mind, and he furrows his brow, and he looks up to the left. And after 15 excruciating seconds and several not-so-helpful hints from me, he says, "Tense. Third conjugation? Or, better yet, accusative?" I tell my kids so often, most of getting the right answer is knowing the 500 or so definite wrong answers. When the students practice using all those grammar terms every day, relentlessly, person, number, tense, voice, mood, etc., they develop habits of thinking that limit their answers to the proper categories. One improvement we felt we had to make to our grammar stage curriculum was the provision of more intensive translation. Two concerns were behind this. First, we wanted the students to see at least a shadow of where their studies were taking them. reading disconnected sentences like, the sailor gives the girl a rose, and the next one, the king loves his people, was not a fair reflection of the type of work our youngsters would eventually do in the upper school. So not only do we want to challenge them more at a younger age, but we wanted to get them excited about where they were headed. I mean, one Latin sentence can have a sense connection to the sentence before and after it? Who'd have thunk it? And most importantly, grammar and vocabulary really stick the more you see them applied outside of a flashcard or chant written on paper. So we all agreed something had to change. But where could we locate readings that use the grammar and vocabulary that our students were studying? Eventually, we decided that someone would have to write original passages. I quickly found it impossible to create a Latin story that stuck to the very simple grammar and vocabulary of our fourth and fifth graders. So I decided that while focusing on the grammar and vocab was paramount, sticking exclusively to it was not a requirement. And so I felt free to include words and constructions the students would not see until later in their studies. The students who want Latin to move a little faster at this age really enjoy seeing previews of next month or next year anyway. So here's a sample story on the overhead in just a second that I wrote for Chapter 7 of our fourth grade curriculum. When presented in class, this story would have macrons, go ahead and move over, sorry, in all the appropriate places, which you don't see here because I printed it off of my Macintosh computer, which I haven't figured out how to get the macrons on quickly yet. And each word that appears bold, or each partial word that appears bold, would have a translation or grammar tip written directly beneath it. These bold words or letters represent either words or grammatical principles the students have not yet seen. Everything else is vocabulary and grammar from the current chapter or ones prior. The stories in fourth grade right now are self-contained, but I've been trying to keep a storyline running in fifth grade about a Roman soldier on his way back home from Spain. So just point a few things out here. Obviously, teachers and soldiers not going to be winning any children's book awards, probably just based on the title, but it's still far, far better than what you're going to get from 10 disconnected sentences. You have multiple declensions of nouns in the same paragraph, multiple conjugations of verbs in the same paragraph, okay, a teacher and a soldier, okay, many duties, different have, teacher and a soldier have many different duties. So I've previewed here a third declension adjective for the child, which doesn't actually look any different from the second declension neuter noun, officia. So that shouldn't really bother them. And the kids that are really fascinated by it, you can explain that to, and the rest of them can just go on their merry way. Teachers teach girls and boys. And these girls and boys are described as being little. And of course, we also teach our kids that if the adjective describes quantity or size, it belongs prior to the noun, so maybe parvo should be here, but I wanted to show them that if you have girls and boys, you can modify them with a masculine noun, because it contains at least one masculine noun. Sorry, modify it with a masculine adjective. Teachers show much grace to their students, or much care. They train their minds, their character, and the memories of their students. So at this point, the kids apparently have not had the genitive plural even. A lesson, a good lesson, is a great gift, an important gift. And always, we will adore, it's a little strong of a word, good teachers. On to soldiers, and the boys wake up. Soldiers fight in wars. If neighboring or nearby barbarians are secretly preparing to take over the country, the soldiers will stop them and overcome them. And the soldiers in legions, they fight and they move. Nocte, this is my favorite touch, is a kid in fourth grade, seen an ablative of time that's well advanced probably we get that in mid-seventh grade for these kids at our school. So at night, they walk through the woods and the fields. And the commanders and leaders order or command many centurions and envoys or ambassadors. Not only do they fight, but also they build roads and ramparts. And the boys will love the swords and the glory of them, or their swords and glory. In these stories, I love to do previews of personal pronouns, because these are words that they're just really not used a whole lot in some of the simpler grammar, and you see them a ton when you read real Latin, and the kids can get very, very weak on forms of isse, id, or tu, or ego. Thank you, Mike. The teacher teaches new languages, and the soldier takes or occupies new lands. Uh-oh, conquest. Maybe not in just war theory. The weapons of the soldier are swords. The weapons, quote, quote, of the teacher are words. The soldiers free many peoples, and the teachers free many minds. Ooh, that's awfully metaphorical for a fourth grader. both is a word that works just like the Latin word for two, duo, ambo. Both ought to build the kingdom of God. Miserable punchline. Okay, thank you. You can turn that off for the time being. We begin instruction from Wheelock's Latin in sixth grade. However, though we did for 3 years, we no longer scare them with much of the actual textbook in sixth grade. And in place of the book, we have a summary grammar and vocabulary sheets for the students' notebooks. These sheets present the same grammar as the first part of the textbook, but in terms that are comfortably digestible for an 11 or 12-year-old. The book can then still be used for the translation exercises that it contains. In sixth grade, we also begin using the 38 Latin Stories book, which provides one story to go along with the final 38 chapters of the textbook. And the textbook has 40 chapters, so they can't really get a good story out of chapter 1 and 2. So they do 1, 2, and 3 as 1, and then 1 the rest of the way. In 6th and 7th grade, these translations are usually myths of some interest to the children, and they reinforce well the grammar and vocabulary of the textbook. Students at this age continue to diagram and translate Latin sentences, both to and from English. And once again, we're forming good habits of describing the language properly. We have competitions in class, and students look forward to what type of game the teacher has in store. I tell my students that we're not playing these games because I'm a fun guy, which I enjoy pretending not to be, though they see right through it, but so they can become quick thinkers under pressure. Sometimes Latin can just get too grinded out and methodical. And of course, these games are great ways to review principles learned the day, week, or month before. There are so many points of grammar to keep fresh that review has to happen every day. While it can take time that you might feel to be better spent getting more material covered, I think it's important that all levels of Latin, and particularly the 7th to 9th grade dialectic, to give the students opportunities to translate on their own, like completely on their own. You can walk around the room to help students with some individual problems that you might not otherwise even know about if you were team tackling a sentence. Let me show you an instructional aid that I use with my students first in 8th grade. That's the first year that I teach at our school, 8th and then 9th and 10th. This is what is affectionately known as a cheat sheet. I run these off at the beginning of the year, laminate them, and put the students' names on them in a black Sharpie. This actually has two sides, so I'll show you the first side first. Okay, this sheet here, I would hand out to an eighth grader in September, and everything on there they've learned in a prior year. So you see at the very top of the page you have five noun declensions with their neuters on the second row. And below that, those personal pronouns I was talking about, ego, tu, and below them, nos and vos. And then right in the middle of the page, isse, id. And then I just had some blank space to fill on the right side, so I just put those six case names and what they usually do, though not exclusively. And then at the very bottom of the page, hic in illae in qui quae quod, unus duo in tres. Just a side note, when I was teaching 7th grade, which I don't do anymore because our school's gotten too large, we would have speed competitions on declining issae id, hic, illae, and qui quae quod, all, let's see, 30 times 4, all 120 forms. And the top time that we had, I think, was 32 seconds to do all of those. And the kids had a lot of fun with that. So just getting to the point where these are so automatic for most kids that they can just, you tell the kid, oh, come on, what's the dative singular of hic, or the feminine dative singular of hic, and they're just burning through it in their head. Weak. And they get weak. But to be able to do it fast is such a great boon for a child. The back side of this page will look like this. There might be a macron mistake somewhere. Not sure. We have verbs now. And the conjugations are along the top. First, second, third, third IO, and fourth. Now, third IO and fourth, if I was really concerned with space, almost could have been lumped together. They're so similar in their present system up here. And then all verbs work the same in their perfect system. The kids are usually pretty good at doing their bon bas bats. But if you've taught Latin for more than a year, you know how the kids are just tortured by whether the verb is a bo bis bit future or an ames et future. So this gives them the chance. But of course, they have to know what conjugation their verb is for any of this to make any sense. And you notice that nothing on here is translated. So it's not like they're just plucking an answer off of a piece of paper. They can use this for reference when we work in class. So every time that we do translate in class, these cheat sheets are on their desk for quick reference. When a student doesn't know an answer to a question, the whole class scours the cheat sheet at the same time and locates the answer together. And everyone really benefits from the process of navigating the sea of information and using their eyes and not just their ears. I guess I'll show you this too because I have it. That's a single sheet of paper like this. But when the kids are in 9th grade and 10th grade, I do a double sheet, an 11 by 17 like this, and now the verbs are joined by a big old subjunctive category. If you're we fear a liar, present tense, and other tenses, and then had some room down here for participles and infinitives, once again, not translated. And then the fourth page, I really didn't know what to do, but I had a fourth page free. So you can't be really over the age of 40, probably, and read this when you have it in front of you, and I'm starting to lose it myself. But I try to use the smallest font possible and put a bunch of words that pretty much have no derivatives that just kill students all the time. So this is like having a quick reference guide for your larger dictionary of words that, you know, I never remember what the word etion means. Oh, there's etion. Okay, great. And these are the words that just came to mind over a couple of hours when I went through a dictionary as ones that they will see a lot too when they read the more advanced authors too. Okay, I can turn that off. Thanks. By the time the student has finished his study of Latin grammar, which at Rockbridge is some point in the middle of 9th grade, we still don't leap directly into the ancient authors. Instead, we use it's kind of an intermediate Latin reader called Fabulae Romanae, which I fear might be out of print, but that's called Fabulae Romanae, which not only retells Roman history from the founding of the city through Julius Caesar, but also gives the students a chance to tackle many grammatical constructions they will see when they read the real authors. So while they get to practice ablative absolutes, passive paraphrastics, cum clauses, and indirect questions, the general presentation of the Latin is less complex than it will eventually be. This type of Latin is still more advanced than what they've seen before, but not the shock to the system it would be if they had to do Cicero upon dumping their Wheelock's book on the shelf. During these few months, one thing comes into very clear focus. Some kids are still heavily challenged, and some kids are ready for more. Very few students are in the middle. And so for the first time, starting next year, in September, we are going to offer a two-track system in math and Latin beginning in 10th grade. It's a little bit tough to understand, but out of scheduling necessity, a student in the accelerated Latin must also be in the accelerated math, since the A-track math will be taught at the same time as B-track Latin. So the next period, right after those two classes have happened simultaneously, B-track math will be taught at the same time as A-track Latin. We were pleasantly surprised, but not shocked, at how well the students fell into one of the two camps, math and Latin simultaneously. Both A and B-track Latin will read the same material, but the B-track students will get more time to digest the grammar and receive explanations that the A-track students might not require. As a result, the A-track class may end up reading a little bit more by the time they're done in May. But both sets of students reach the same broad goal. They apply their grammar training so they can read and appreciate authentic Latin literature. So rhetoric Latin at Rockbridge coincides with the 10th grade year. Students continue to translate on their own and together, still discussing the grammar like we always have. We begin with selections from Caesar's Gallic Wars, and students particularly enjoy the portions about the customs of the Druids and the wildlife in Germany, mainly because I do. I don't have a lot of patience for reading about all of the self-centered military exploits of Caesar. So we show them some of that, but the really fun stuff takes place when he gets on side tangents about culture. Then we read portions of Cicero's oration against Verres, the court case that made Cicero's name. Next, the students tackle Pliny's letter to Tacitus about the eruption of Vesuvius and his letter to Trajan about the persecution of the Christians. And we close the year with my favorite unit, Ovid's Metamorphoses. Currently, we read Pyramus and Thisbe, Daphne and Apollo, and Daedalus and Icarus. In other years, we have also read his retellings of the myths of Pygmalion. That was like a one and done, sort of. I should have researched a little bit more on that. Midas and Bacchus and Philemon. And time permitting, we have read some Vulgate Bible or St. Augustine. Students take frequent pop quizzes in 10th grade, always on the previous day's reading. This encourages them to take good notes in class, reread at home, and come back to school the next day understanding what they've read and prepared to move on. Students all have dictionaries and their cheat sheets on their desks in 10th grade, ready to look up an unfamiliar word or determine for sure if a verb is subjunctive or not. Before I close by showing an exercise that I have my 10th graders do, let me address point 6 on your outline, which is what it means to know Latin. I had a student several years ago confess to me in class publicly that he felt he really didn't know Latin because he couldn't read it like he could read English. And several classmates of his, they really had the same sentiment when it came out. And I realized right then that I'd failed to communicate clearly what a difficult and time-consuming task reading Latin is, even for a teacher like myself. To start with, we rarely have a familiarity with all the vocabulary we need before we translate a passage we've never seen before. This means you will need to spend time in a dictionary, doing what I talked about yesterday, wrestling with definition and the wide range of meanings that many Latin words can have. And you'll need to look at context. You'll probably need someone, hopefully some provided notes on the facing page, to give you advice about the strange use of the ablative and the seemingly inexplicable subjunctive verb in this clause. It will not be fast at first, and it may never become fast, but it will get less slow. So at the end of their Rockbridge Latin careers, I now make it clear to my kids that they should not be disappointed with where they have arrived. They know Latin in the sense that they know its grammatical fundamentals. They know where to look for help. They know how to use that help. And they know that no passage is beyond their understanding if they have the time. And finally, the last item on your outline, the rhetoric Latin exercise. This is really something that could be adapted for use with all ages of Latin students, but I use with my 10th graders as we read Ovid, whose grammatical complexity and poetic flair make his work a natural fit for this exercise. The goal of the exercise is to give every student an opportunity to stand in front of the class with confidence, to varying degrees, and explain absolutely everything of grammatical and poetic interest in about a 5 to 7 line passage. So we have a little drawing out of a hat as to who gets which sections of lines. And then I give them class time over the next week to prepare. And they ask me questions on their own, but I do as little nudging as I can, hoping that they will discover things all by themselves. So this next sheet I'm going to show you on the overhead are the guidelines that I give them. Okay, because every student, except the one that goes first, will have somebody who went before them. First thing they do is to summarize the lines that they are about to present and tell what immediate action precedes it. Read the Latin passage aloud with proper pronunciation, stress, and rhythmic feeling. If your passage ends midline, continue to the end of the partial line. So we're not reading Latin poetry, and Latin poetry is generally in, well, there's two main kinds, but the kind that we read is in dactylic hexameter. So you don't want to stop in the middle of a line, even if the sense ends in the middle of the line. You can keep on reading those two dangling words at the end. Third, translate the passage slowly, discussing the forms of words and grammatical relationships between them. Explain, for instance, why nouns are the case they are, and why verbs are subjunctive, for instance. If any construction is difficult for the average 10th grader to understand, it should receive special emphasis. It's going to be a lot of constructions. Bring to the audience's attention any poetic devices that affect the meter, sound, word order, or meaning here. And then I have a bunch of jargon here. These are things that they can identify and explain, mostly Greek names. Not only identify these poetic devices, but show how they work to enliven or enhance the poetry. Fourth, read the passage through one more time, concentrating on smooth English language expression. Don't worry about transferring the English to any meter in particular. And about half the class takes that as a challenge to make it sound really snazzy. And number five, answer questions from the class and instructor that you have not explained or have not explained to their satisfaction. That's where a large part of their grade comes from, because they may think they're doing a good job, and there's always one or two faithful students that just don't get it, and you've got to explain it better for them. And I hardly ever have to end up asking questions on my own, because I've either got students that really care, or ones that love to drill whoever's up there and make them squirm. And in the 2 years that I've required this exercise, the students have done exceptional jobs. It requires them to put at least 4 separate skills into practice. They read that Latin aloud, and they do so with feeling and confidence. They translate in front of their teacher and classmates. They do more than translate. They have to teach. They have to explain why words are the forms they are, and do so to the satisfaction of everyone. And finally, they must evaluate the passage, saying perhaps whether they found the author's use of metaphor convincing, or his word picture particularly effective. Why or why not? So I have a sample portion of 7 lines from Daphne and Apollo here. I must get some water before I read this. What I thought I would do is just give you sort of a condensed version of what their 10th grade presentation might actually look like. I wanted to get a student on tape doing it, but that kind of didn't come together. Probably not a lot of volunteers either. This passage occurs midway through Ovid's retelling of Daphne and Apollo, and in this myth, I'm sure most of you are aware. The god Apollo has been shot by Cupid with an arrow that causes love, golden tipped, and he sees the water nymph, or the woodland nymph Daphne, who's the daughter of a river god, and she has been shot by a different arrow that makes her run away, tipped with lead. And this has all happened because Apollo and Cupid got into an argument And Cupid thought it would be very funny if Apollo were smitten and could do nothing about it because the object of his affection was horrified by him. So this is a famous simile that Ovid constructs about the situation. It begins in 533. Just as a dog... Oh, and I tell my students, proceed left to right as you explain everything. Don't jump around, because when a Roman heard his own language, he didn't go, oh, got a subject, time to find a verb. Whoop, got it. No, he heard a prepositional phrase in wakuo, and not even the entire prepositional phrase, because arwo is stuck over here. In wakuo, arwo, all go together. So, just as a dog in an empty... Empty what? Empty what, Ovid? Well, rabbit, cum, it's a floating cum, it doesn't mean with, because the word after it is not ablative. So, when? So back up a little bit. Just as a dog in an empty, and then a word rabbit that doesn't go with empty, rabbit, when, oh, Gallic. That dog is French. Canis Gallicus. Okay? Arwo, field. Wakuo, arwo, okay. So the whole thing now, just as when a dog has seen, perfect tense, a rabbit in an empty field, and hic. It's a great chance for the students to explain how hic and its counterpart ille work to refer to previously mentioned nouns. And this one, the thing that is more recently mentioned, which grammatically is Gallicus, the dog. And this one seeks its prey or its prize or booty with its feet, ablative of means. And that one, no verb. Petit seeks. You have to repeat the verb. This is what I was talking about yesterday with how the Roman authors love to gap is... how I described it. So, and that one seeks safety. So we've got one French dog seeking its prey, and that rabbit seeking safety. Alter, the one, okay, in Hysero. Ooh, that form is tricky. And it ends in an O. Okay, so it's ambiguously dative or ablative. And the student would have to explain why in the world or where this form comes from, because this is not a standard word. You're not going to find it on your cheat sheet. In hyreo, okay? So this is a future active participle. Now, the kids will all have their cheat sheets out. Okay, so now why it's dative. Similis requires a dative. The one similar to. And then in Hysero, as a participle, a verbal adjective is functioning as a noun here with no noun. This is so complex. The one similar to a creature, have to supply to a being, to a creature about to catch hold of something, about to stick to something. Now and now, or now and again, or repeatedly, yam yam kwe, hopes to possess, teneo, and with an having been extended, but there's no noun, he stringit, vestigia, he draws close to the footprints with an extended rostro, snout. Okay. Alter, the other. We had the one, now the other. In ambiguo est, is in ambiguo. It's kind of what it sounds like. It's uncertain. there's an ambiguous thought in its head. The other is uncertain on whether it has been snatched. You get this kind of a cartoon picture in your head as you can see one creature chasing another and the jaws open and the other one flies right away as the jaws close. Did I get away? Yes. Just lost a little hair on my tail. Okay. It's uncertain whether it's been caught, and a ripeter is snatched away from the very bites, or from the jaws themselves. Okay, and he leaves behind the touching mouth, the mouth touching it. Okay, and now the metaphor closes. So the god and the maiden, this one is swift with hope. And that one, the feminine one, is swift. Once again, gapped. There is no word swift again. You have to go back to here to get it. That one's swift from fear. Okay? And the student would have to, during that whole process, explain why comprehensus sit, for instance, was subjunctive. Sit being a subjunctive ending because of the indirect question implied in the questioning phrase uncertain. Etc. But I don't want to torture you with jargon here. And the kids have really impressed me with how hard they work on pronouncing these things properly and really reading them with a great feeling. So many things about your school's Latin program may look different than what I've talked to you about today. You may use a different textbook, and you may eventually read different authors. But if you take away one guiding principle from today's talk, it will be this. A competent Latin translator does not burst into existence from memorizing vocabulary and sets of endings, though he must do these things, but from wrestling with grammar and vocabulary the same way he will when he is older, in as much translation as possible. Thank you. I will be up here to answer questions, or we can do it publicly right now. Go ahead.
Sure. What do you do about students who come in late?
Yes, great question. I just realized that I hadn't addressed that. What does our school do about students that come in late to the program, coming in, for instance, in sixth grade or in eighth grade or ninth grade? Every student's going to be in a little bit of a different place coming in. Some have had a little bit of Latin that doesn't correspond at all with really what you do, and some have had zero. And what we've done for the past couple of years is basically our school does not take any students new past the ninth grade, correct, pretty much, with very few exceptions. In the younger grades, we don't feel that they're so far behind in Latin that we can't make it up with some pretty intense summers. And every year our school offers a Latin boot camp, so to speak, in early August. And I think a lot of schools do that, and you can probably find one in your area that does. And if they're so far behind that there's no hope of starting with their class, we have made occasional exception in the past for them to get tutoring during the school year and sort of have a class audit with the real Latin class in school until they're really ready next year. But basically, we require the parents to get that student up to speed by hook or by crook. So we offer what we can, but we also realize that our school's resources are not unlimited during the summer, and we can't just solve all the problems like that. Okay, thank you. Oh, yes?
Yeah.
Right. The cheat sheet that I showed you, and if you would like to have that, I can send it to you as a Word file in an email, and you can change it all you want or leave it as is. That is used almost exclusively when we read together in non-graded type of exercises. I have occasionally let a class use it on a test that's really seeking to test something very different. Where I don't feel that it will be a real crutch, but yeah. Yes.
I've forgotten what you said. Your curriculum was a third, fourth.
Yes, I kind of intentionally didn't say what the curriculum was in third through fifth grade. It's not a textbook, and that's why. So I can't tell you go out and buy this textbook. I do believe that we sell it. Is that correct? Our Latin curriculum?
We sell 1 year that's a transition.
Gotcha. Right. It has been pieced together from a lot of things that we've found useful over the years. I guess maybe originally inspired by Latina Cristiana in some respects, but the vocabulary that we use in those years doesn't have that much in common, I think, with Latina Cristiana. So it's very much like what we do in the sixth grade that I did mention. So it's lots of organized worksheets and grammar lessons on pages that the students can keep in an organized notebook, so they can go back to the chapter that has that particular lesson, see the principles, and then there's worksheet after worksheet to practice them. But the things that they do learn in third through fifth grade are then going to be reviewed in sixth grade at the beginning. So sixth grade is probably 50% a review of third through fifth, but in that intense wheel-locks way, plus another 50% that's brand new to them. You may get in touch with me at G. Colin, my first initial and last name, at rockbridge.org.
Okay.
And I've been informed that we sell the fourth grade transitional curriculum. Any other questions? Yes. Written homework for the young ones. I don't think very much. We tend to keep the homework in general at our school to reading as much as we can for classes that are really reading intensive. We do give Latin homework, but really only when it is required that the kids get extra practice with a concept that really needs it. Yes? Absolutely, yes, and I apologize if that didn't come across as strongly as it could have. Yes, we put great value in diagramming both Latin sentences to translate to English and in English sentences to translate to Latin. Occasionally, you'll find a kid who can somehow master the diagramming and still mess it up, but it's pretty rare. To diagram that sentence is the first step to doing it well. Yes. Yeah. Just as oh, for like the exercises to do when they're in seventh and eighth and ninth. Well, they always have their Latin textbook with them. Yes, the Wheel-Locks text has much more comprehensive than that sheet would offer, certainly. Yes.
In English,